Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Before Gene Owl, the Ice Age was almost a blank page to most imaginations. Cavemen and women, clubs, furs, fires. That's about it. Then, more than 30 years ago now, back when disco was still king, came Gene Owl's The Clan of the Cave Bear. Young Ayla, our modern human ancestor, raised by Neanderthals. Love, drama, and a lot of research to let us see what really might have been. 45 million copies later, her epic Ice Age series has, we're told, reached its end. This hour on Point, Gene Owl and the Land of Painted Caves. You can join the conversation. Have you been reading Gene Owl from the beginning? What have you learned? What's your question? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Gene Owl, best-selling author of The Clan of the Cave Bear, and out now, the sixth book in her Earth's Children series, The Land of Painted Caves. Gene Owl, thanks very much for being with us today. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is some stack of work. I mean, these are each 600, 700, 800 pages long, and you've done six of them now.
Yes, yes. I started out with a short story. I wondered if I could write one, and I found out that I couldn't.
Did you ever imagine at the beginning that you would get, you know, all these thousands of pages into the Ice Age, Gene?
No, I really didn't. I was going to write it. At first, I thought it was going to be a short story. Then it ended up I was going to be a novel. And then it was going to be a big sprawling novel in six parts. And then I came to the realization that each one of those parts was really a complete book.
You were 40 years old when you began working on this, I guess, back in the 70s. You're 75 now, six of these wonderful monsters later, all kinds of sales around the world. I mean, every language you can think of. What is it? What have you come to think over all those years? You've clearly been writing some deep interest in the reading public here. What do you think it is that attracts people back to this time? After all, before you really laid it out in this way, it was kind of a no man's land. People didn't think that much in detail about it.
That's right. I'm not sure. You know, I like to think that maybe they like the fact that I've written a story and it might be a good story.
Well, yes.
Maybe it's partly because everybody's kind of interested in their beginnings, and this is kind of everybody's beginnings, because these were the first appearance in Europe of basically anatomically modern humans.
Mm-hmm. As you got deeper into it over the years, and at this point, you've done so much research yourself, you're a very deep well of that. What is it that you most want to convey to the modern reader? What's the sense of that time that you found yourself most, you know, most interested in getting across?
Well, I think mostly I wanted to get across the information that I was learning as I was doing the research, because there's so much there that we don't know. I mean, face it, we're most of us educated by Hollywood when it comes to caveman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, they're still back in the days of, 1902. When they were still thinking that Neanderthals were these hunched over, hulking savages. And of course now we know that our prehistoric ancestors have been walking upright since 4.5 million years ago, since Lucy, and that there's just, didn't know what I was going to find.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got into it, I really thought, this is fascinating stuff, and how come we don't know it? And then I finally said, okay, I'm going to tell it, and I'm going to tell it right.
And you have told it and told it and told it. Now, in what you say is the Land of Painted Caves. Take us back. What's the era? I mean, you're talking about, in this book, really, much less than the lifetime at this point. Your key protagonist, a girl when you began, then later, now young woman in the latest, Ayla, is just something, I don't know, in her mid-20s in this latest book.
Yes, yes.
So where is this little speck of time set in the vast sweep of time? And what's the general human circumstance or Cro-Magnon circumstance at that time?
Okay, it's set somewhere. I'm taking a bit of literary license, excuse me.
We imagined.
A little bit of literary license when I do this. It's between 25,000 and 35,000 years ago.
Okay.
And the reason is because even some of the dating, you know, they say 27,000 plus or minus 500 years.
Carbon dating. Mm-hmm.
You know, you're throwing away 1,000 years in the dating as it is. So, and because I wanted to have this the period when the Neanderthals were still around. And that to me was a kind of a fascinating thing. It was the Ice Age. There were woolly mammoths. There were cave bears. There were cave lions. And the cave lions in Europe were not like America's saber-tooth. Hmm. They were like the African lions of today, except they were from 1.5 to twice as big.
Okay.
You know, get yourself to a zoo, look at a lion, and try to figure one twice that size, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this was just a fascinating period, and it was the Ice Age. That means that the pancake of glacier that comes down from the North Pole, which was maybe 2 miles high.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever go look at a mountain like we have in Oregon, Mount Hood, it's like a wall of ice that high. It's, you know, to me it was just wondrous. I thought it was a wonderful new period in time to write fiction.
This encounter of Cro-Magnon, or our modern human ancestors, and Neanderthal, the earlier strain, is right at the heart of kind of the narrative of your book.
Yes.
When you were first conceiving and writing The Clan of the Cave Bear back in the 70s, came out in 80, was it clear to archaeologists at that time that these two strains had lived in the same time, in the same place, and almost certainly interacted, or was that a leap of imagination?
No, it was known. It was known, but it's only been recently that they really have accepted that there was a great deal of contact. Because, you know, my imagination was, if you've got contact, you've got people meeting, eventually you're going to have, you're going to exchange genes. You know, that's just the way
meeting
it is.
Meeting equals mating.
Yes. And especially in those days, you know, we don't know what their society was exactly like. But there were some things that you can get. I mean, what's real in the books are basically bones and stones.
Mm-hmm.
And microscopic particles like pollen analysis and so on. But you can get a tremendous amount of information from bones and stones. For example, in The Clan of the Cave Bear, you know, we have this character who's the Mogur, who's the holy man, the one who kind of adopts Ayla. And my first original idea was, you know, she's staying with these people who are different, and they're letting her stay because she's taking care of an old man with a crippled arm.
They're Neanderthal, she's not.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you're different from everybody around you, then they're, then, you know, it's both ways. You cannot have the one of them saying, oh, she's different, and then, of course, when she looks at them, they're different. You know, that's how it is. So that was a kind of a fascinating thing. How did these two different kinds of intelligent humans, because as I got into it, it made me realize how intelligent the Neanderthals were. And they really, I think the thing that really got my attention was when I read about Dr. Ralph Solecki's dig in Iraq at Shanidar Cave. That was when we could still dig in Iraq, and it talks about archaeological digs. And the first skeleton that they found was of an old man with a crippled arm. And
this was a Neanderthal.
This was a Neanderthal man.
Mm-hmm.
And he died in a rock fall, but previous to that, his skull had been injured, and the regrowth indicated that he was probably blind in one eye. His arm had been amputated. Now, that doesn't mean torn off. That means amputated.
Deliberate.
And he had a crippled leg. So my first thought was, okay, probably with the atrophy, he had been crippled for a long time. Who would take care of a crippled kid? Well, you know, maybe somebody who loved him. And when he was a young man, who is giving him food and clothing and a place to live? He's not out hunting woolly mammoths.
So and yet he survived to some age.
And yet he survived to some age. And I'm saying, somebody took care of him. And does that mean that their society was able to appreciate and take care of their weak and wounded. And then what happens to, you know, the old thing about red of tooth and claw?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that to me was a tremendously eye-opening adventure, if you will, when I started to really understand who these people were.
When you project or have projected your novelist's eye back into this era, what's the general reaction you get from the bones and stones professionals, the archaeologists? Do they roll their eyes and say, oh, Gene, you've got a wild imagination, or nod and say, yes, you know, maybe it's as you imagine it?
Well, you know, last night I was at the Museum of Science, not the Science Museum, but the Natural History Museum.
Mm-hmm. In New York?
Mm-hmm. Here in New York. And Ian Tattersall is, he's now emeritus, but he's been working there as an anthropologist, paleoanthropologist for many years. And, you know, we had a slightly different opinion about whether or not they could interbreed. But he said last night when he introduced me that these were books that could have been. And that's what most of the archaeologists and paleoanthropologists have said. These are books that could have been.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Clan of the Cave Bear author, connoisseur of early humans, Ice Age life, Jean Owl. She's out with her latest, she says the last, in her Earth's Children series, her sixth huge volume. It's The Land of Painted Caves. She joins us today from New York. 45 million copies of these sold since 1980 in this series around the world. Gina, if you could read just a little bit for us. I have learned very well that we'll have people who, you know books from 1980 like the back of their hand, and others,
yes,
younger, who may not know them at all. You've got a little bit there where Ayla herself, she's in her 20s now, she's mated, she's
got an
infant child, and again in the book she introduces herself, I guess, as you imagine the formal greetings of that time. These are greetings which in themselves suggest the kind of elaborate social interaction that you imagine having gone on in that time. So here, if we were to meet your protagonist at the time of the setting of this book, The Land of Painted Caves, if you could read a little bit about how she would introduce herself and then maybe explain it a little bit for us.
Okay. She faced the young man and held out both hands, palm up, in the formal gesture of openness and friendship. I am Ayla of the ninth cave of the Zelandani, acolyte of Zelandani, first among those who served the great Earth Mother, mated to Jandalar, master flintknapper and brother of Joharan, leader of the ninth cave of the Zelandani. Formerly, I was daughter of the Mammoth Hearth, of the lion camp of the Mamutoi, chosen by the spirit of the cave lion, protected by the cave bear, and friend of the horses, Winnie, Racer, and Gray, and the four-legged hunter, Wolf.
This is a woman in your telling with an elaborate introduction required because of her very kind of unique history in that time. But the introduction itself says, wow, these are people who wanted to know a lot about one another. These are not grunting cavemen.
That's of course, true. And the formal introduction is the sort of a thing that says, okay, I am letting you know who I am. I want to know who you are. They didn't have the kinds of tools that we have today. There was no Facebooks.
You're kidding.
but other people were important to them. I mean, that's one of the things that you need to know if you're going to survive. I remember listening to a speech given by Richard Leakey, who is the son of Louis B. Leakey. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, if you're a four-legged animal and you lose one leg, you can get by on three legs. But if you're a bipedal, if you're a two-legged person, and you lose the use of one of your legs, you're dependent upon a friend or somebody to help you move.
Society.
Because you can only hop on one leg for so long.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that they needed each other. There were not that many people at that time. It was the Ice Age, and they were living in a paraglacial region, you know, not on the ice, of course, but just south of it.
You're imagining southern France in this latest book, somewhere in that cave drawing, cave painting area.
Exactly. And this is what, to me, is a way of showing how much people were important to them.
Give us the thumbnail sketch of her biography. Again, we'll have people who know it extremely well, but others who won't know what she... This is, as you imagine it, an orphaned child, a particular child raised in another particular environment.
Well, that's it, because she... The books, you know, the first book, The Clan of the Cave Bear, starts out with Ayla being caught in an earthquake. And it's an earthquake that destroys the rest of her people, whoever they were. And then she's five. And she's wandering alone for a while, following a river. And has, you know, runs into a cave lion, for heaven's sake, and hides in a cave, but she gets scratched when the cave lion reaches in.
Mm-hmm.
So she's, you know, and you get, it's really true, you get scratched by a lion's claws and it's going to do you some bad service because there's a lot of infection from that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And finally she collapses and there's the vultures overhead. And then the second chapter starts with the clan that also lost their cave in that earthquake. And the medicine woman comes by and she sees that this is a child. She knows it's a child of the others.
That is not the Neanderthals.
Right. They have come into their territory. They're aware of them, but they tend not to associate with them so much. But she sees that this is a child, and because she's a compassionate woman, she picks her up and takes her along with them. And that's the beginning. So in The Clan of the Cave Bear, I'm using that kind of a circumstance to show that they were even compassionate towards those who were not them, the others.
Indeed, though, there's also suspicion there. You project a different kind of intelligence in these two.
Yes.
I wish you'd describe the two, the Neanderthal intelligence you imagine, and you give it respect, and then the Cro-Magnon closer to us. How do you imagine the sort of compare and contrast their intelligence as?
Well, if you talk about Cro-Magnon, we're talking about our great-grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
Many times over,
mm-hmm.
they are anatomically modern. They very well accepted that they are they have the same range of intelligence that we do. They had the same ability to speak. They had the same emotional reactions and psychological responses and so on. They made their living in a different way. But they were people that we could understand. When you get into the Neanderthal, before I could ever write a Neanderthal character, I had to invent my Neanderthals. So I did a lot of reading about not only who they were. There was like Philip Lieberman out of Brown University,
mm-hmm.
who came up with the theory that there was probably some limitation in the Neanderthal ability to articulate. And he took the skulls and he measured various points of Neanderthals, and then he also measured
speech capacity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's soft tissue. But he also measured the modern humans. He did, you know, monkeys and various other primates and the dogs and babies, like human babies. A thing that I learned that was really fascinating is that the reason that human babies don't start talking until they're give or take 6 months of 2 years is because as long as they're nursing, you know, then they can swallow and breathe at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
When the voice box drops, which is what happens at about that age, so that it allows us to have the big chamber to resonate, to be able to speak, then, you know, we now choke. People have choked to death. And animals don't. I mean, you know, dogs can, mm-hmm. you know, swallow a huge lump of food, and it doesn't choke them. But with people, that must have been a tremendously important addition in our evolutionary history, because if it endangered somebody's life, it had to be even more important, the ability to speak and to communicate.
tremendously important, tremendous act of imagination that we've seen in six volumes now from Jean Owl, pushing back into the 35,000 years ago and our ancestors there. The first was the Clan of the Cave Bear in 1980, and then just every few years, ever since, 45 million copies out, The Land of Painted Caves, out now. You know, the duration of your time in working on this is, it's not quite archaeological, Gene, but it's enormous,
it's long
at this point. And we thought, well, let's look out and see if we can find somebody who may have, way back at the dawn of your series time, read these, and today be somewhere in the field. And you know, it wasn't that hard. Stand by there in New York, Jean. Joining us right now from Santa Clara, California, is Michelle Bazanson. She's an assistant professor of anthropology at Santa Clara University. She teaches You're the Clan of the Cave Bear in her course on popular culture and biological anthropology. She's a biological anthropologist and primatologist.
Yes.
Michelle,
yes.
Now Professor Bazanson, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
So here you are. You're now teaching this in university. When did you first touch the world of Jean Owl, Michelle?
I read it in fourth grade.
You're great.
Really,
you're wonderful.
It was my first encounter with anything like this. It was prehistoric fiction, and I think many of my female friends read it as well.
Is it possible that you're in the field you're in today, biological anthropology, because of that Clan of the Cave Bear reading in fourth grade?
Fueled my interest in human evolution. I really think that Jean Owl kind of tricked me at the time. She tricked me into learning and seeking more detail at the library. I talked about the book with my parents, and at the time, these ideas kept me up at night because, believe it or not, in fourth grade, we weren't learning about human evolution. It was really exciting, and it inspired me to think about what was known and what was not known.
So tell us how you use Jean Owl's work now in your class. You're looking at popular culture and how these issues are presented there. Exactly how do you use the work of Jean Owl with your young students today, Michelle?
So many of these students, even coming into college, haven't encountered issues in anthropology previously. So we have a requirement here at Santa Clara in science, technology, and society, where we recognize and evaluate the relationship between science and society. And one way we think about science is through popular fiction. So we accomplished this in this class through evaluating popular presentations in biological anthropology, and then we compare that to how data are presented in the scientific literature and how things have changed through time. I mean, historically, there's been a lot of new information since 1980, so we can address how this is presented to the popular public.
And I know one of the questions that you put to your students, and maybe you can give us a good answer to it, is what is most surprising, you ask them, about Jean Owl's interpretation of Neanderthal behavior. Is there a right answer to that, or a neck of the woods, Michelle? What's it look like?
They're all over. I mean, I think one thing that the students really enjoy in the book is the way she describes the use of plants and how Issa, who is Ayla's basically her
adopted
mentor.
Adopted parent, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and how she teaches Ayla how to select different types of plants.
This is the Neanderthal female who takes Ayla under her wing.
Right, right. And students have found that description really fascinating. I had a student look into ethnobotany and what we actually did know or didn't know from the fossil record and what we know now.
Is it a surprising depiction to you? Is it aggressive interpretation, or does it sort of stack up with what you know of that era?
It's a really visual presentation, and I don't think we have a lot of information about that during that time, but it's because a lot of that stuff doesn't preserve as ideally as we would like. But
you don't get the voice being
not the voice, and maybe
yeah, you don't get the plant doesn't last
right around the
right.
campfire. Oh, this is so great to have Jean Owl, you and hear your kind of successor generation on with us together. It's just wonderful. Michelle, I know you also ask your student about Jean's perspective on Neanderthal modern human interbreeding. What do they come back to you with? Do they buy the kind of interaction that she presents there? Do you buy it?
Well, it's interesting because our ideas in biological anthropology have changed about what we think about these possibilities. for a while, we were very much not accepting of those ideas. And
interbreeding. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And recent research is providing all kinds of new exciting ideas about how this might have happened or how much of a contribution was made into the modern human genome by Neanderthal genes.
And so, it's what, 1-4% of Neanderthal DNA is what all people of European extraction have? That's how I read it.
Mm-hmm. Some of the interpretation. I mean, there's all kinds of different interpretations about it. And then students love it because, I mean, you get to think about sex.
Sure. So, of course, that's got to be popular. You know, we'll look at that. But, Jean, I have to say, one of the moments when your depiction of that era seems most enviable to me is when you depict those at that time, and mainly women in this regard, in the natural world, in a forest or savanna, wherever you find them, and their hyper-intimate understanding and awareness of all the plants around them and their potential efficacy to address all kinds of ailments. I envy that sort of, you know, 60-dimensional awareness of life all around. It's just a fantastic notion. And you're suggesting maybe a necessary interaction for them. They didn't have high tech. They didn't have hospitals, but they had very intimate relations with the natural world.
I think that's probably true. Nobody can guarantee it, of course. I mean, they've done a little bit of study scientifically, but you can't really know. But it just makes sense to me. If we look even at the more modern hunter-gatherer societies, they know their world. We know how to write. They know how to look at a plant and see the leaf of it and realize what the root underneath the ground would be. But that's what they did. I mean, for what? How many millions of years were we hunter-gatherers before we started putting seeds in the ground on purpose and putting fences around animals?
Michelle Bezanson, we've only got you for another half minute here. Here's a great popularizer of a period of time that had scarcely been popularized. What's your sense of Jean Owl's gift to you, your students, as they try to project back in time, Michelle?
I think it's a nice way to get access to some ideas and to spark doing more research and thinking more about these ideas. I mean, I sometimes wonder if I hadn't chosen this track, this career track, how I might be engaged in news stories about research and human evolution, given that this book fueled an interest in these themes at an early age. How might a young person who hasn't had an opportunity to explore this, how might they respond? And I think it's important for sparking interest in our research.
Read Clan of the Cave Bear in fourth grade, now assistant professor of anthropology at Santa Clara University. Gee, now you're passing something on here. Michelle Bezanson, we're grateful to you for spending a few minutes with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you, Michelle.
You too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Clan of the Cave Bear author, connoisseur of early humans, Ice Age life, Jean Owl. She's out with her latest, she says the last, in her Earth's Children series, her sixth enormous volume, The Land of Painted Caves. Set in that Ice Age time, southern France, land of cave paintings, Lascaux, and all the rest. She's been in a lot of them herself, has brought in a lot of detail up out of that world of bones and stones to an enormous popular audience. Jean Owl joins us from New York. She was a 40-year-old mother of five when she began. Now here we are 30-plus years later, and she's still bringing it to the table. Lots of response online here. Jean loved Clan of the Cave Bear, most captivating series ever read. Catherine says, it's fair to say I was obsessed with these books as a preteen, and lots of callers as well. Let us go, if I may, to Jill in Evansville, Indiana. Hi, Jill. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I read Jean Owl's books when they first came out and was fascinated by them. And as an artist and a teacher, now I teach art and humanities at University of Southern Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still using her books. I require my students to read the first book, and I'm especially interested in seeing this new book that's going to come out, because when I was a youngster, I was able to actually visit the cave of Altamira in Spain, and was fascinated by this strange experience that I had, and had no idea what it meant, but was absolutely overcome with the drawings in that tremendous cave.
Jill, let us look at that, because that's very much at the heart of the new book, and I appreciate your call there from Evansville. Jean, talk to us about the cave paintings, cave drawings, and the significance that you're finding in them. You go to the shamanistic here in Land of Painted Caves.
Yes, well, that, of course, is an imaginative thing, but it really makes sense to me. Now, I've been in the Land of Painted Caves. There are several caves described, and I have been in every one of those caves except one, the smallest one. I couldn't find a person to help me get into it. And all the rest of them, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the help that I've received from the archaeological and the paleontological community. Almost anything that I've wanted to find out, there have been a helpful scientist right there who's been willing to show me and take me in. I have been into Chauvet Cave. I've been into Altamira. I've been into Lascaux and the original Lascaux, not just the copy.
Mm-hmm.
And I am so grateful to them for letting me do that, partly because it is such a marvelous experience, just as your listener was talking about. It's when you're in the ambiance of that cave, you know, it's not like looking at a photograph or a wall mural that's on a flat surface. One of the things that they did quite well was to utilize the sort of bumps and dips, the natural mm-hmm. bumps and dips in the cave wall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of them might be a shoulder blade and one of them might be a stomach bulge. But when you see them, and then, you know, if you do it under flickering firelight, which sometimes the archaeologists who were showing me the caves would say, let's turn off the flashlight, which
sure.
is steady light, and put fire and see what happens. And as that light flickers, it really seems, you know, the shadows move. And there, it looks like those animals on the wall are kind of moving.
Coming to life.
Yes.
What's your sense?
They knew what they were doing.
Well, that is clear, and they are powerful. I mean, you really have applied your imagination here this time. In that process, what conclusion have you come to about what they were trying to capture or convey in those paintings, drawings?
I nobody can know for sure, but I think the idea of some sort of shamanistic thought. I mean, if you look at, you know, paintings on walls in southwestern United States, and you find out that sometimes what they represent is somebody going out and finding who they are as an adult, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a matter of, it's a shamanistic thing. Sometimes it's, you know, much, much more simple. It's just part of the world. They see this. I mean, I remember going to Australia and meeting with some, I went to Bachelor College and gave a talk to the Australians who were attending that school,
mm-hmm.
and mostly Aborigines. And the women were taking teaching classes, and their husbands, since most of them were married, they'd sort of set out camp around the college, and they were, you know, they were giving them classes in how to fix cars so that they would have something too. But these young people, when I met them, they were like, I mean, some of them could have been from Southern California and very modern, and some mm-hmm. of them were still coming in off the bush 6 months of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones. I talked to this one young woman who lived most of her time in the bush, and she said, she talked about them, you know, these ghosts, these figures that protect certain sites, as though they were real. And she was telling me, well, there's this couple, and there's the two hunters, and they protect that area. And it was the president of the university who said, you realize, of course, that she's not talking about real people. She is talking about the ghosts or the spirits of those people that protect it. But she was talking about it as if they were real.
And maybe 25,000 years ago, that same sense of spirits in those caves, maybe the depictions in those caves. Lynn in Burlington, Vermont. Thank you for calling, Lynn. You're on with Gene Owl.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Gene. How are you?
Well.
Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for the work that you've done in this series. I have always had a hobby type of interest in both archaeology and paleontology. And people, you know, they'll see the stones and the bones, and they'll forget that these were actual people, mm-hmm. with lives and feelings and emotions. And the interactions with Issa and Kreb and Broud and Brun, and then later on with Winnie and Baby, and later Jondalar. I mean, it's just amazing to have them actually brought to life and to actually see the different interactions and everything that Ayla has.
Lynn, do you ever pause, Lynn, and wonder to yourself, well, Gene's got a great imagination, but could they really have had this complex and rich a social life, or does it just seem logical to you, Lynn?
I don't see why they couldn't have had it. You know, you look at the ancient cultures or even the primitive cultures that we have now, and their societies are intensely complex.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I'm so looking forward to this last book.
Thank you.
I hate to see the series end, but it has just been such a great experience. And, I mean, you really identify with these people. You don't see them, as I said, as bones and, you know, and history. They are people to you. And I think that their spirit should thank you for doing
this. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Lynn, thank you. Thank you very, very much indeed. Gene, what about the place of women in your imagined society here? It's very powerful. It's quite central. In this book in particular, while men are hunters, they're not alone in that hunting. And when it comes to the social and cultural and mystical life of the society you imagine, women are absolutely dominant. How have you come to that over the years?
Well, one of the things that I found in reading anthropology, just, you know, current anthropology, about people who live as hunter-gatherers even today and did, you know, up until a couple hundred years ago, some of the Native Americans and so on. And basically, what I've discovered is that in their world, in their society, the woman's contribution was very much appreciated. In other words, it wasn't that society that painted the women as less important. It was the Europeans who came and studied them and had that sort of, you know, women as second-class citizens role in their world, and so that's how they reported it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk to when you find out, and now you know, it's easier to find out that everybody's contribution was considered very important. Yes, maybe the men tended to go hunting more, but that's because they don't have to be carting a baby around who's going to cry and scare the animal away. And besides that, if you're a gatherer and you're finding food in the earth, it's not going to run away, so you're going to bring something home. You're going to feed your people.
Mm-hmm. In this book, you make the spiritual leader a woman. Is that, do you imagine that as well? That could be different in every sort of clan grouping, or do you imagine that women actually dominated in that role?
I have both males and females in mm-hmm. as what we would call shamans or mm-hmm. spiritual leaders. The one that in this particular case happens to be a woman is, you know, just because she turned out, you know, sometimes when you write a novel, characters sort of jump off the page and demand to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what happened with Zelandanyi. She was, you know, and she's a huge woman. She's a big mm-hmm. woman. And, of course, they have found sculptures that are about the size that you can hold in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very well-endowed women, you know, big buttocks and big breasts
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that must have been very important to them.
A sign, certainly, of somebody who's up at the top of the eating chain anyway.
You got it.
One way or another. Let's go to Gwen in Acton, Massachusetts. Gwen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Gene.
Hi.
I'm thrilled to be talking to Gene Owl. She's created such an amazing series of stories. I downloaded Land of Painted Caves on my Kindle. I was reading it in the wee hours of Tuesday morning when it came out. I had a question. I was thrilled to hear the story behind the character of Kreb.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you had any similar background information about the part in the Plains of Passage where they come across the people that are firing clay sculptures and vessels.
The archaeological evidence. What about it, Jean?
Yes, absolutely. In Czechoslovakia, when it was Czechoslovakia, now I guess it's Czech Republic, not too far from Brno, they have found sites, and one in particular where it's there's a kind of a house construction that's a little bit off from the village itself. And underneath the bones that they put on the floor of it, they found the skeleton of a woman. And in that structure, there were also it was also a kiln, because this is where they were firing clay. And they weren't making pottery. They were making art. They were making figures of women. They were making figures of mammoths and of lions and that kind of thing. And, you know, they have found some of those. So that, and that was dating about, I don't know, I think it's 25,000 plus or minus a couple thousand. And so that's, you know, and they have found the actual kiln that they used. So this, you know, the earliest firing of clay was not used for, you know, mundane household purposes, but for art.
One kind of insight after another, firing the clay 25,000 years ago. Let's get a call here from Lebanon, Tennessee, and Ellen. Ellen, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm so glad to be able to speak to Jean All. I have loved the whole series. I've already bought the latest book. I had to buy the book because I've got the first edition of all of them.
Wow. Okay.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And I think the books are great. I love reading about history. I love Native American history, too. But I did have one comment. The books are wonderful, but you put too much sex into the later books. Clan of the K-Bear was the best of all.
Of course, that had a rape scene. That was probably the most difficult scene that I ever wrote.
It wasn't as explicit as some of the other stuff. The other was just a little bit too explicit.
I think when you get to the end of this book, you may have a better sense of why I felt that was essential to tell the story. Because they were living in a world in which they had no responsibility. They didn't really know the male role in procreation. And so they didn't think of being responsible for the results. And I think that, as I say, get to the end of it, and I hope it's a thoughtful ending. It's one that I hope will make people think and make them realize how important it was, you know, to describe the sexuality. Besides that, all of the sexuality that is described is tender and loving. And I've never used the nasty four-letter words, but then trying to find words to describe parts of people without that, you know. It was a difficult thing to do. But I'm writer enough that if I write a sad thing, I want you to feel sad. If I want to write a funny thing, I'd like you to smile. And if I'm going to write a scene of intimacy, I want you to feel something.
You definitely write it with gusto. There's no question about it. Ellen, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, if I may. Amy in Hampton, New Hampshire. Amy, our time is short, but you're on with Jean.
Hi, Tom. Thanks, Jean, very much for writing this last book. I've been looking forward to it for years.
Thank you.
I was about 10 when I read the first book, and when the second book came out, my mom wouldn't let me read it because of the sex. But my friend and I snuck it and read it under the covers anyway. It was so fascinating.
Hot stuff, Amy, and you're still reading all these years later.
Oh yes, in fact, I've been inspired to start writing my own.
Good for you.
Good luck. Good luck, and good luck to you, Amy. Thanks for calling, Jean. We've just got a minute here. I mean,
okay.
I wonder at the end of this great series, if indeed that's where we are. You know what you're suggesting? Can we find who we are in the experience of these deep ancestors in time?
Well, I think we can find out something about ourselves. You know, one of the things that was really amazing to me is when you get that far back, there is no evidence of warfare. There's no evidence. I mean, yes, sometimes there was one case where somebody had a spear in them, but we don't know, you know, it was stuck in the bone and the person died. But we don't know if that was because somebody was throwing it at him or if he got in the way of somebody throwing a spear at an animal.
But there's certainly in your books, there's anger, there's envy, there's competition, there's human strife.
But there's ways that they built into their culture to handle it. And, of course, that's what the natives are like, the Inuit and the Aleut and so on. There are big ways of having arguments but not fighting.
Are you really finished with this series, Jean? Are you really finished with Ayla and all the rest, really, really, truly?
I feel like I am. I mean, I don't know for sure. I've got a lot of other information and so on, but I feel that this is a good ending.
It's been a big cycle, an incredible epic, and all those millions of readers. Jean Owl, it's been wonderful to talk with you today. Thank you so much
for
your time.
Thank you, Tom. It's been wonderful to talk to you, too.
Jean Owl, author of The Clan of the Cave Bear, and right on through to her latest, she says, the last in the series, The Land of Painted Caves. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.